WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's a new biography of Henry Kissinger that's been called the book to end all books on Kissinger. My guest is the author, Walter Isaacson. The Kissinger that emerges in this book is brilliant, but conspiratorial. Kissinger was President Nixon's national security advisor and President Ford's Secretary of State. He won a Nobel Peace Prize for his negotiations to end the war in Vietnam. He negotiated the opening of relations with China. The expression shuttle diplomacy was created to describe his style. Kissinger became a superstar diplomat. He was on the cover of more than 20 issues of Time magazine. And he made the celebrity party scene, often with a beautiful actress on his arm. Isaacson's book is not an authorized biography, but Kissinger did grant him a couple dozen interviews.
He is a person who deeply, deeply cares about his place in history, his reputation, and explaining himself. I think one thing he didn't like about the book is that when I started researching his life, his childhood, everything else, you sense a great mixture of ego and insecurity in him. And it's a combustible mixture that leads to somebody really caring deeply about how people portray him or how people think of him.
Did your mind change a lot about Kissinger during the course of writing the book?
Well, I tried not to make up my mind before I started what I thought of him. As I did the research, I found that I was a little bit more impressed with some of the brilliance of his foreign policy maneuvers and the structures of foreign policy created. The detente with the Soviet Union being balanced against an opening to China, and that all being balanced against the shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East and a somewhat messy withdrawal from Vietnam. But how he saw all of those linkages impressed me. On the other hand, the more I learned about his method of operation, his secretiveness, his willingness to deceive the State Department, the way he would tell one side one thing and then shade it a different way when he talked to the other side, I felt that that was not only not very impressive, but it was ultimately destructive, because foreign policy in a democracy has to have some openness and some honesty, because in the long run, it's got to be based on the support of the people, the support of Congress, the support of the bureaucracy, the support of the whole State Department. And when you don't lay that groundwork by openly describing what you're doing, it comes back to haunt you.
Well, let's talk about his secrecy. You describe Kissinger and Nixon as co-conspirators. Now, Kissinger was Nixon's national security advisor and secretary of state. In what way did you see them as co-conspirators?
They liked to sit in that hideaway office Nixon had in the executive office building right across from the White House. They would sit there for hours figuring out surprise ploys they could pull off and gambits, such as the secret opening to China where Kissinger took that trip without even telling the State Department or anybody else. It was a perfect secret that he was going to go to China and then announce that Nixon was going to make a grand trip to China. That was done sitting around with Nixon privately, either in the executive office building or in the Lincoln sitting room in the upstairs of the White House late at night, where they would plot these things. And they were so afraid of leaks, such as leaks about the secret bombing of Cambodia that was done without the cooperation of the top levels of the Defense Department or the State Department. They were so afraid of leaks that they began wiretapping their aides. And after a while, you had a program of national security wiretapped where even Kissinger's closest advisors and the closest advisors of the Secretary of State and Secretary of Defense and a lot of reporters in Washington all had wiretaps on their home phones to make sure that nobody was spilling secrets. And that became very destructive, because Nixon and Kissinger, I think, relished the wiretap transcripts and the wiretap reports a little bit too much and were just a little bit too eager to tap their aides. It was an illegal program, and it really undermined trust in government.
Well, you say that Kissinger himself was indirectly the subject of a wiretap.
That's right. Nixon was distrustful, too, and he thought Kissinger, correctly, he thought that Kissinger was doing a lot of the leaking. So some of the wiretaps were put on reporters that Kissinger was known to talk to. And Nixon, of course, secretly taped his conversations in the White House. Kissinger, somewhat secretly, a few people knew about it, taped his own phone conversations, including his private phone conversations with Nixon, and had transcripts made, and he would show them to a few close aides.
Did Nixon know?
I think Nixon knew that Kissinger had a taping system on the phone. I'm pretty sure, having read some of these transcripts, that Nixon didn't realize that the taping was on all the time and that even the most private conversations were being taped. Likewise, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, all of these people had secret taping systems. And Melvin Laird, who was the defense secretary, was getting the wiretaps from the National Security Agency, which is a super secret agency that listens in on long distance phone conversation and satellite transmissions. So everybody was sort of tapping one another, doing things behind one another's back. And an important point to bear in mind, I think, is that this atmosphere, this sort of conspiratorial atmosphere, is what really laid the groundwork for Watergate.
Did you get access to any of the tapes of the phone calls?
Yes, those tapes are very secret, they're very sealed, but different people have access to them. In other words, certain aides or certain of the principals, certain of the people who were doing it, would keep their tapes or their transcripts, especially of amazing phone calls. And so people, as I went around and did my reporting over the past 6 years, people would show me some of the telephone conversations that were had or some of the secret memos that were taken at the meetings. And, of course, Haldeman took notes at every meeting that he had with Nixon and Kissinger, and those were available, some of them in the National Archives in Washington and some of them through Haldeman and Ehrlichman. So if you as you wander around for 6 years talking to people, they're kind of eager to show you the things and mementos they've saved. Now, for example, during the Yom Kippur War in October 73, Watergate was at its peak. Nixon was about to fire the Watergate special prosecutor, Archibald Cox. He was totally out of the loop when at the end of the October 73 war, because he was so preoccupied with Watergate. He was drinking somewhat. He was going to bed early. So the phone conversations of Haig, of Kissinger, and of some of the other players reveal them bringing the country to a nuclear alert and not telling the president about it. And all of that, to me, was absolutely fascinating.
You know, you described Kissinger and Nixon as oddly matched and oddly repelled by one another. In the oddly repelled by one another category, something I think is actually pretty amusing, is you describe how when Nixon would get particularly rambling on a conversation with Kissinger, Kissinger would invite an aide to listen in while Kissinger, like, rolled his eyes.
Kissinger had a dead key, what was called a dead key, on his phones, which meant that if he was on the phone and he wanted an aide to listen in, they could pick up another extension and not be heard. And the most amazing case of this is the very famous Final Days scene where Nixon, the night before he's going to resign, calls Kissinger over to the White House, and they pray together, and Nixon starts crying and talking about his place in history. And afterwards, Kissinger, drenched in sweat, walks back to his office in the West Wing of the White House, and there's Lawrence Eagleburger and Brent Scowcroft, two of his top aides, both of whom are now in the Bush administration. And as they're sitting there and Kissinger's recounting this amazing, dark scene, the phone, the private phone, rings from Nixon's study, the Lincoln bedroom study, and Kissinger picks up the phone. Nixon starts to ramble, and Kissinger signals to Lawrence Eagleburger to pick up the dead key, and they listen in on that conversation.
Why do you think that? Actually, I kind of dropped the ball here. You were just before this mentioning how Kissinger kind of brought us to a nuclear red alert during the Yom Kippur War without informing the president.
At the very end of the October 73 Yom Kippur War, the Israelis and the Egyptians were both violating a ceasefire that had been put in place. So the Soviets were threatening to send in troops to enforce the ceasefire. And Nixon could not be roused from bed, according to Al Haig, who was then the chief of staff for the president. He had gone to bed, probably, according to the conversations, had a couple of drinks, and Haig said, "We can't wake up the president." So in a meeting that Kissinger chaired in the White House with the defense secretary, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Al Haig, and Kissinger, and a couple of other players, they decide to bring the country to a nuclear alert as a way of scaring the Soviets into backing down from sending in troops. It may have been a proper move, but the amazing thing is Nixon didn't find out about it really until the next day.
Do you know what his reaction was when he found out?
At least according to the meeting notes, he didn't have much of a reaction, and I think he was so preoccupied with his own Watergate problems that he just listened to the briefing. Another thing on that October 73 war, Kissinger is in Moscow trying to negotiate the ceasefire right as the war is about to end. And he calls up Al Haig and says, and is quite upset because the president fired off some cable. The president had not been paying much attention to these negotiations, but all of a sudden fires off a cable that says Kissinger has full authority to do whatever he wants. Now, usually Kissinger would like such a cable, but at that time he was trying to stall because he wanted the Israelis to be able to push their offensive just a little bit further, and he was telling the Russians he couldn't do anything until he checked back with the president. So Kissinger is furious at this cable that wasn't supposed to come from the president, giving him full authority to make a decision on the spot. So he calls up Al Haig at the White House, and he says, "What are you doing? Why are you letting the president send off these cables?" And it's a Saturday night, and Al Haig says, "I'm too busy. I can't talk to you." And Kissinger says, "What could be happening that's so important on a Saturday night in Washington?" And Haig pauses for a moment, and he says, "Well, it's what's called the Saturday Night Massacre, and Nixon has just fired Archibald Cox, and the Attorney General, Elliot Richardson, has just resigned." And there's another pause, and Kissinger says, "I understand. I guess you're busy."
Well, you know, it must be pretty alarming when you're writing a book like this and you find out how dysfunctional our government can really be.
Well, they were dysfunctional, but I must say, because you have to give credit where credit is due, there were a lot of brilliant initiatives, too. It was that dark conspiratorial side of Kissinger and Nixon that led them, I think, to understand how the Soviets would react to an opening to China, how to balance off the Chinese desire for a better relationship with the United States with the Soviet desire for an arms control treaty, and to use that balance going behind the backs of the Soviets, then going behind the backs of the Chinese, so that they would be pitted against each other and be less likely to support the Vietnamese communists and lead to a quicker resolution of the Vietnam War. So you have to have a sort of conspiratorial mindset to conduct that type of foreign policy. And to be fair, there are some advantages or at least some benefits that came from that foreign policy, as well as some frightening scenes.
I'll tell you what, let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more about your biography of Henry Kissinger. My guest is Walter Isaacson. This is Fresh Air. Walter Isaacson is my guest, and we're discussing his new biography of Henry Kissinger. Why do you think that Kissinger was so secretive? Why did he develop such a furtive approach to diplomacy?
Well, I start off the book with Kissinger being a young Orthodox Jewish boy in a suburb of Nuremberg, Germany, called Furth. And the Nazis were just coming to power, and Jewish kids were always at a risk of getting beaten up. And he became a great soccer fan, Kissinger did, as a young boy, as a 6 or 7 or 8 year old. And they passed what was called the Nuremberg Laws, which prevented Jews from any public gatherings, including soccer games. So Kissinger and his brother and a few other friends, but mainly Henry Kissinger, would sneak into the soccer games using an assumed name or pretending to be a boy from a different school or that sort of thing. And every now and then he would get caught and would get beaten up. And it was growing up with this beleaguered childhood, but also knowing that he was smarter and more clever and more brilliant than the people around him, that I think made him feel very vulnerable, very insecure, but also very arrogant and egotistical. And that mixture led him, I think, on his as part of his diplomatic philosophy, to believe in a quest for order, to believe that power rather than moral righteousness determined the way the world worked. And it also led him to try to seek approval from powerful people, and also led him to be, I think, somewhat conspiratorial as he tried to gain support from people on various sides of an issue.
That's a psychological analysis and, of his secrecy. You have a political analysis as well.
First of all, Kissinger did not have an appreciation for the openness of the American democratic system. He was more of a realist who liked conducting diplomacy in secret. He felt that if you consulted with Congress and the whole State Department, say, about the opening to China, it would never take place. And to be fair to him, if there had been a great national debate about the opening to China, and if Congress had known about it and it had leaked out, it would have been much harder to have the opening to China. Likewise, he wanted to keep control and get the credit, as did Nixon, rather than allowing the State Department to have credit for certain things. They wanted the credit and the surprise of the opening to China. Also, on the Vietnam peace agreements, the State Department was conducting negotiations, but Kissinger wanted to have secret negotiations in Paris that he could control, that he could get credit for, that he and Nixon could be the ones that would be in charge of. And so he opened up the secret Paris peace negotiations with Le Docteau in Paris.
I think perhaps Kissinger's most famous secret policy was the secret bombing of Cambodia during the Vietnam War. You say that the secret bombing of Cambodia wasn't meant to be as secretive as it became, but the secrecy gradually became more important than the bombing itself. What do you mean by that?
That's very important to understand how destructive the secretiveness can be. What happened was there were communist sanctuaries of Vietnamese communists that were based right over the border in Cambodia. And there had been a few cross-border raids where we tried to wipe them out. But those sanctuaries kept growing, and it was hard to conduct the Vietnam War with those sanctuaries there in Cambodia. So secretly, without consulting Congress or even without consulting the State Department or even the Secretary of the Air Force, Nixon and Kissinger decided to launch one major bombing strike against the communist sanctuaries in Cambodia. They hoped to knock out the headquarters of the Vietnamese communists that were based there. And they felt that if they did it publicly, then there would be great outcry, there would be more riots in the streets, Congress would cut off funds, so they decided to do it secretly. Well, the bombing happened, and it did not knock out the headquarters. It was not a very successful bombing, but they were able to keep it secret. There was no outcry. So they decide to bomb again, and the single bombing that was supposed to take place becomes a series of bombings over an entire year. And they became more and more afraid that the secret would leak out. And that's why when the first leak appeared, there was a story in the New York Times that gave an indication that there may be bombing in Cambodia. That's when the wiretapping program started. That's when they started tapping the phones of various people. And eventually, it's when they formed a plumber's unit to try to stop the leaks. And the wiretapping and the plumber's unit and eventually Watergate was far more destructive to the United States than that bombing ever was, that whole year of secret bombing ever was, to the communists based in Cambodia.
Well, this actually gets to one of your greatest criticisms of Kissinger, which is that he created a foreign policy without morality.
Kissinger was a realist, in European terms, a practitioner of realpolitik, like the people he studied in college, Metternich and Bismarck. American foreign policy, since Woodrow Wilson, and even before then, you can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson, is usually based on certain values. Jefferson said that he would swear on the altar of God eternal opposition to tyranny over the minds of men, and that should be the basis of our foreign policy. Wilson talked about democracy as being the basis of our foreign policy. Americans very rarely like to get involved in the world unless they believe they're doing the right thing. Unlike other countries who can engage in balance of power diplomacy, Americans like to believe that they're fighting in order to protect their ideals, not protecting some balance of power or stable world order. And I think eventually Kissinger publicly argued that morality should not play a major role in foreign policy, that that was too romantic and too sentimental. We had to conduct an unsentimental foreign policy based on national interest, not based on some misguided notions of human rights or values or democracy. I think that that was an important foreign policy to pursue for a while after the Vietnam period, because we had to reestablish our role in the world after the debacle of Vietnam. But I do not think over the long run, in America, in a democracy, in an open democracy where people have some say in foreign policy, you can conduct a foreign policy in which you treat morality and values and human rights as minor considerations rather than the fundamental basis for our foreign policy. We can now look back. The Cold War is over. And what won the Cold War for the United States was not brilliant balances of power or that we were able to match Soviet power missile for missile. What won the Cold War in 1988, 1990, 1991 was that the rest of the world began to accept the American values. And it was the American values and the strength of its system that ended up being the thing that caused the rollback of and the dissolution of the Soviet Empire. Not our balances of powers, but the respect people had around the world for our ideals of democracy and human rights.
Kissinger really wanted to be in the Reagan administration. Reagan didn't want Kissinger to be in the administration. Why not?
Kissinger faced a dilemma in American politics. He was reviled by both people on the left, the doves on the left, who saw him as a strange Lovian warmonger. But he also was resented and in many ways hated by people on the right. The conservative movement in America never accepted Henry Kissinger, partly because he was part of the Eastern establishment, the Council on Foreign Relations, the Trilateral Commission, the Rockefeller wing of the Republican Party. So he never got along well with the right wing of the Republican Party. When Ronald Reagan made his challenge to Gerry Ford for the Republican nomination in 1976, he lost that race and then later, 4 years later, went on to be president. But when Reagan challenged Gerry Ford for the nomination in 76, he made Kissinger the issue. Reagan ran against detente. He ran against the fact that Kissinger was conducting an amoral foreign policy, one that was not willing to stand up against the immorality of the Soviet Union, one that was too soft and was more interested in arms control agreements than it was in taking on the Soviet Union. So Ronald Reagan made Kissinger the issue, just as Jimmy Carter did, by the way, from the left. Jimmy Carter made Henry Kissinger and detente and the lack of values of Kissinger's foreign policy the issue. So Ronald Reagan harbored a resentment and a distrust of Henry Kissinger that he never really overcame.
Walter Isaacson is the author of Kissinger, a biography. Isaacson will be back with us on the second half of today's show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.